how do we treat deep carious lesions? Is there a difference between the primary dentition and the permanent dentition? And what does the evidence say when we look at the recently published Cochrane review? These are things we're talking about in this podcast. It's a preparation for the 100th birthday of the GC Corporation, and there will be a lecture as well on this topic, so please go to gcdentalcampus.com and register for this event. Have fun listening. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm connected here over the internet with Clarissa and Falk. Welcome to the show, you two. Really great that you joined me tonight. And you both have a lecture at the GC Online November Symposium about a really interesting topic, the deep carious lesion. You also already told me that there is a new Cochrane review on this topic. And maybe you can tell me, or you can tell all the listeners who have not read this review, what are the key points we have to know?
Yeah, thanks, Georg. I think, well, first, the main key point is that there's basically nearly no indication any longer, especially for deep lesions in teeth with a vital pulp, to do what we were taught for 100 years, to do complete or non-selective caries removal. That is, I think, something which is very clear and coming out of the review. For deep lesions, don't do full removal of all caries tissue. Try to be conservative, try to maintain tissue using stepwise or selective removal, or in the primary dentition, for example, the Hall technique.
I know the Hall technique. I never practiced this because I barely treat children. I think it's quite effective as a technique, Clarissa.
Yeah, that's indeed. Thank you for the invitation for this podcast. It's very nice to be here. The Hall technique is indeed very effective and much more effective than the traditional treatment that we used to do with complete caries removal and a restoration. And by the Hall technique, you don't need to remove any caries. You just place a crown, a stainless steel crown, on the top of the tooth, and you cement it with a glazionomer cement. So you close the cavity and there's no caries progression. And there is, if you follow the indications, there is also a very high success, and it's around 97% of success in a range of 1 to 5 years.
I have stainless steel crowns in my office, but we probably have to, before we can just demand it directly on this highly carious teeth, there probably has to be some pre-work. Can you kind of walk us through what you do before you do the Hall technique?
Sure. There's no tooth preparation. What you do is that sometimes you have to make space for the crown. And to make space for the crown, you place this separation elastics that are these orthodontic elastics. And you place them around the contact points. So if you have a permanent molar, then you place it distally of the 5, for example, and medially of the 5 when you want to place the crown on a 5, on the second primary molar. And you leave this elastic band there for one day up to a week, depending on the strength of this contact point. When you remove it, you have enough space for the crown. And then you have to choose the best size of the crown. And sometimes you do have to cut a little bit of the borders just to make it easier to fit. And when you feel that this crown fits on the tooth, you don't need to push it completely because you know already that this is the good size. And if you push it completely, sometimes it's difficult to remove. If that happens, then you use an excavator, and from lingual to occlusal, you can do it, you can remove it, but it's not always necessary. And then you fill the crown with a glazionomer cement, with a conventional one, so not a resin modified one. And you place the crown and you push it, or you ask the child to bite on a cotton roll, and for about 2 minutes, then you remove the excess of the cement and your treatment is done.
That's kind of great. Actually, I tried that one time, and kind of the part where I had to place the orthodontic retainer was not very successful.
Oh, it was painful. Was it painful or was it too difficult?
Well, I kind of had a trick that I have to use two pliers and to place it into this contact point. But actually, I didn't succeed at all. My orthodontist told me that there's a special forceps for that, but I don't have it. Do you recommend this kind of forceps?
Not really. To make it more child-friendly, what we do is that we have two pieces of dental floss.
Okay.
And then when you have these two pieces of dental floss in the elastic band, you just pull them apart and then the elastic will be flat. And you can go underneath the contact point only using the floss. So you bring the band underneath the contact point using the one of the sides of the floss, and then you will bring it up, pulling up one of the sides of the floss, and then it will be around the contact point, the elastic band. This is easier than pushing it down.
Okay.
Because the elastic normally is thicker than the contact point, and that's the entire meaning, that you want to make a space there. So pulling up is easier than pushing down.
I just read a lot about the whole technique because I think this is actually in children a very, very interesting treatment option. But I haven't used it yet so far. It's quite a pity.
Yeah, you should try. It's maybe the first time you find it a bit weird. But it's well accepted by the children as well. I mean, I asked you just a second ago about the pain because in one of the studies that we did using the whole technique, it was reported that the children found it a little bit painful, the elastic. So they find it a little bit uncomfortable having the elastic. But the treatment itself, not having to have an anesthesia and not using rubber dam and not preparing the tooth with a burr and only placing the crown there, it's very quick treatment. So you have a very short time that you need. And it's very successful. So the children like it. It's survival. So it stays there for a long time. Yeah, I think it's definitely the treatment for cavities in primary teeth.
Falk, are you treating any children anymore or you basically moved to permanent dentition forever?
I never say never. It's not a lot of children. I see children mainly of children of friends and family and so on. And sometimes I treat them. So, for example, I have a friend's daughter who has or had an active caries lesion on one of her primary molars. And what we did there, we didn't use the whole technique. We used another strategy, which was also discussed in the review and systematically assessed, which is called the non-restorative cavity control technique, where you are basically slicing up the interdental area where there's the caries lesion. You're opening up the lesion by that way and thereby make it accessible. And then you train and educate the parents to brush regularly. And you can also apply in office fluoride varnish, for example. And thereby you can, at least in theory, arrest the lesions. And that's what we did for that child. And I think, I mean, she's due in the next weeks, but she is... I think she will lose the tooth now very soon. I don't know the exact age, but we said, okay, 6 more months to go and then it will be gone. So hopefully it is gone soon. So it's more something to get the tooth over the line. But for her, it worked. If we look at the data in the review, there are at least doubts, let's say, that way. And I think the main issue is it's highly dependent on the compliance of the parents. You can open it up, you can make it cleansable, but if then nobody brushes, same as before, then it doesn't work. And that's the biggest weakness. And that's why, at least in my belief, the whole technique is so superior because it doesn't at all depend on that compliance. Even in the contrast, it covers the whole tooth, even those areas which were not caries, with a big stainless steel container so that tooth can never ever become caries again, even on the other surfaces. So something we, at least here in Germany, we were taught, not me, but other people were taught in the 50s and 60s and 70s, the so-called protection crown. I think that idea, we abandoned it for the permanent dentition because it's nonsense there, of course. But here for the whole technique, it seems to work out. And otherwise, to come back to your question, I'm mainly treating permanent teeth, yes.
I don't want to talk too much about stainless steel crowns and everything, but do you have a rule of thumb, Clarissa, which tooth should get which size of crown, or is it the experience thing?
When you use crowns, you have the ones made for the primary, the right primary, the left primary, upper primary, the one that, so they are made for each tooth, the D4 and the E5, or this kind of stuff. But sometimes they don't fit. Sometimes you have children with too big teeth, and then you have to choose another one and be creative. But how to choose a crown, it's you look at the size of the tooth and you look at the size of the crown, and it's a little bit of trying, and maybe you try two or three the first time, and then after that you know a bit more.
So we can say it's try and error and experience.
Yeah, but it's not so difficult. Yeah, just try it.
Let's move more to the permanent dentition. Basically, you both are treating the permanent dentition. I have to admit, I'm personally haven't read the review yet, but I'm not so on the side of we don't need, well, let's say it, but just selective caries removal is enough. Yeah. How would you convince me? Because, for example, when I say maybe this caries is kind of irritating, still irritating the pulp, how would you convince me to kind of consider this kind of treatment?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think it's a fair question. And coming from a mainly endodontically driven person, it's even an expected question. So let me try to maybe come back to a number of points. First of all, how would I convince you? I would show you the data. And by showing you the data, I can at least show you that it's not one study, it's always a number of studies from all over the world in very heterogeneous conditions showing exactly the same story. There's not a single study showing something different. In the optimal case for the non-selective, so the complete removal, you could say it doesn't make a difference to do it or to not do it. We see this, for example, for non-deep lesions, so for the rather shallow ones where you don't have the risk of pulpal damage there, it's probably okay to do either that or do it selective, or I wouldn't do stepwise because it's just an effort there, but to do non-selective or selective because the pulp is not at risk. But if you go close to the pulp, then we certainly see the data that these techniques clinically work. Second of all, what else would I show you or tell you? This is something which also people from the other side of the river, from the endodontic village basically, and not the cariological village, have understood, at least here in Europe. If I look at the statement of the European Society of Endodontics, they are very, very forthcoming and open for these less invasive strategies and very positive about them. And the only ones where we don't see it are the American endodontists, which is interesting because that even led to a statement of the European endodontist just about a week old, criticizing that and discussing if this is not something where the different professions in dentistry could come to one single conclusion, because of course for the practitioner it's absolutely nuts if a cariologist and the European endodontist say do selective and stepwise and the American endodontist say don't do it and all use the same data. That's pretty confusing. Why are some people, like maybe the American endodontist and maybe also yourself, because you just made the same argument, why are they at least cautious? Which is absolutely fine. Being cautious is a good thing. It is because of these histological studies you're citing. And the main thing which people are always coming back to is a single study, which is about 2.5-3 years old, where they cut, I think it was 12 teeth, after some weeks after selective removal, so where people left caries tissue close to the pulp, and these teeth were deemed for extraction anyway. So they said, well, we just do selective removal, and then some weeks later we take them out and we cut them into pieces and we check the pulp, and there they found inflammation. And then I must say, well, what did you expect? Of course you find inflammation. You also find inflammation beneath the direct pulp capping. You find inflammation beneath most restorative materials. And you even find inflammation at the tip of the root, at the apex, in the bone, when you do a root canal filling. So some kind of inflammation is probably the normal form of the body of dealing with these kind of injuries and harms. And at the end, what is important to me is, how does it work clinically? I'm not treating pulpal cells, I'm treating the human being. If I look at these data, then it's very, very strong. So if I need to decide, do I make my argument based on 12 extracted teeth, or do I make it on, I think it was more than several thousands of treated children and adults in these studies in the Cochrane Review, then I would rather choose latter side and go with the less invasive removal. I hope I convinced you.
Well, it's not that easy, Falk, you know that. Because since your topic is deep carious lesions, and I mean, every dentist has something in mind, a patient with a deep carious lesion. Could these deep carious lesions be excluded from the data?
What do you mean excluded? Why would we exclude them? This review is mainly on, or at least these studies focusing on selective and stepwise removal. Of course, they mainly dealt with deep lesions, not with the non-deep ones. Hmm. Because I would agree with you if you say, why should I do it for a shallow lesion? Why can't I, to say it very, very simple, why can't I clean it properly? Well, there I would say, well, yes, right. Clean it properly and then do a nice filling. But for the deep lesions, we always have the debate around the pulp. And I think that's why these techniques are also more successful there, because they are not harming the pulp.
No, I'm kind of aiming on, I mean, for example, when I read the Bjørndal study, I think there are some pictures included, which what was included in the study and what was excluded in the study, some X-ray pictures. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm kind of asking, when you're doing a review, you probably have some definitions for what is a deep carious lesion. Probably, for example, it's close one, for example, 1 meter close to the pulp. So what's the definition for a deep lesion in your?
There are different definitions. One, the most commonly used one is it's in the inner third, radiographically extended into the inner third of the dentin, which of course is only arbitrary because it's a 2D radiograph and you don't know where it really sits. Another definition, and that's more focusing on the very deep lesions, that's the one Lars Bjørndal is using, is in the inner quarter of the pulp. And then there is that kind of additional, let's say, warning sign that at least some studies used, that there should always be a continuous band of radiodense dentin above the pulp, so separating the carious lesion from the pulpal tissue, because otherwise, if you have the radiographic impression, the pulp is directly already in contact with the carious tissue, there could be an issue. Although, as I said, it's only a 2D radiograph, so I would be a bit careful there.
Chris, how do you convince the dentists, like, apart from the literature?
Well, I would convince you from a cariology point of view that caries is actually a disease, but a dysbiosis, so there is like a collapse in the ecosystem of the mouth, and what you need to do is actually to bring it to a healthy oral ecosystem. And how do you do that? By keeping it clean. But do you need to remove them? Oh no, you need to remove them until you can place a restoration. And that's why for shallow lesions sometimes we do need to remove completely, because otherwise we don't have enough space for our restorative material and then it can break the restoration. But for deep lesions, you want to keep the tooth still alive. So that's actually your main goal. And keeping the tooth alive can be combined with selective excavation, where there is some bacteria left behind, but they will die. They won't have access to food anymore, being very simple. And then your ecosystem will be reestablished in a healthy oral ecosystem. Not sure if I could convince you.
I mean, it's a long process. I mean, the thing is, at the beginning, I kind of really liked the idea, but I also had failures where I kind of thought maybe if I would have removed more, maybe it wouldn't have been a failure. Of course, we don't know that. But how do you treat your failures? Because every dentist has failures, I would guess. How do you manage these failures? I mean, the Hall technique is basically nearly 100%. We don't have failures here. But in permanent dentition, when you treat patients every way you want, endodontic, complete removals, selective removal, you always have a certain failure probably. So, for example...
Of course, you have failures. And I think, especially for the deep lesions, these will be either endodontically, as you indicate. And if that happens, and it does happen, I fully agree, even in studies it happens, and of course it also happens in clinical routine, because it's not magic. It's one treatment option, and better, at least the data say so, than alternative treatment options. And it's, as Clarissa said, it's grounded in biology. So it has some biological plausibility that it works. But nevertheless, sometimes it doesn't work. And that can be, for example, because our pulpit diagnostics are just not very good. I mean, what are we doing? We are looking at the radiograph, as I said, hoping that there's some layer separating the pulp from the carious tissue. And then we are putting something cold or hot on the tooth and poking around a little bit. And then we think we understood the pulp, which of course we don't. It would be crazy to assume that. So I think that's one of the reasons that whatever you do to such teeth to maintain the vitality, in some cases you will not be successful. And then you need to do the endodontic treatment. But that's on the other hand, also the beauty about it. You can still do endodontic treatment. You do not lose that option. And that's where I have a problem with being overly invasive in the first step, that if you say, well, I don't like to take that risk, I'm going all in either with non-selective removal, or there are even some dentists out there, we know this from surveys also here in Germany, who say, well, for deep lesions, I always do endo treatment right away because that works. Well, also for endodontic treatments, we have same failure rates, and then you lost another treatment option already because you used it right in the first place. So I'm always with my patients as careful and cautious as I can be and as needed. And if I have failures, then I can still go one more step onto the ladder and escalate it a little bit, which is absolutely fine. That's what dentistry is doing. And if we take all the steps in a stepwise way, then we can hopefully maintain the teeth for quite a long period of time.
I think when it comes to children, you mainly want to avoid pain. You want to avoid that they become afraid of the dentist, so that they develop a fear for the dentist. And that's why you choose also the most minimal invasive treatment as possible. And what Falk just said, when you are in doubt because you don't see a dentin breach, or because there are symptoms of irreversible pulp inflammation, then you don't try this. Yeah? Then you make your choice. But when you see that there is still the possibility of healing, then I wouldn't go straight to the most invasive treatment, giving an anesthesia and having a long treatment so that child has to be for a long time in the chair. This can be just the start of a child that will be afraid of the dentist, and that's exactly what you want to avoid.
For example, when the children is in pain and you kind of diagnose your irreversible pulpitis, what are your treatment options you choose in this situation?
Then you have to see about the behavior of these children. If the cooperation is enough, you can do a pulpectomy, and then it's like the root canal treatment for the primary tooth. If there is no cooperation, then your option is on the extraction. And this is a pity because both treatments are not comfortable and can lead to fear for the dentist. So we hope to be there before they are in pain.
Are these the treatments you usually do under general anesthesia? Do you also are able to manage this without any general anesthesia? Or sedation.
Yeah, when a child comes in pain, you have to help it normally at the same day. So it's without general anesthesia. And sometimes with sedation, sometimes with oral sedation, sometimes with nitrous oxide. But this all depends on the cooperation of the child, the age of the child, and the procedure that needs to be done.
So interesting. So you both think that the future of deep caries treatment will be just selective, and you don't see, as you already stated at the beginning, no indication for anything else anymore.
No, I wouldn't say that. It would be sad, somehow disappointing, wouldn't it, if we say it's over now, everybody goes home. I think there's still a lot to do, and what we are, for example, doing in my department here is we just set up a large multi-center practice-based study where we compare selective removal versus pulpotomy, because we say, well, maybe it's not the fault of the non-selective removal. Maybe it's the fault of, if we do non-selective removal and open up the pulp, of how we deal with the pulp. Maybe direct capping is just not the thing. There, as you know, a number of studies showing that pulpotomy might be interesting. And maybe that could be a very good alternative, maybe even better than the selective removal, that we say, well, go in with non-selective If you open up the pulp, no problem, do a phlebotomy. I'm very open for these things, but we need to investigate them. We need to show that this is really true. At the moment, we just don't know it. And at the moment, we know that selective and stepwise and Hall, that they all work. And the second thing is, and that is also something which is sometimes forgotten, the beauty about selective and stepwise, maybe with Hall, it's a little bit different, but that's easy. Everybody can leave a little bit more carious tissue there. It's not complex to do technically and not hard to teach. And that is different with a phlebotomy, for example. I think this will be something where we will need to educate dentists very specifically on how to do a phlebotomy in permanent teeth. And that is already an implementation hurdle. And that's also something we need to consider. But I think there's still lots to do, and we'll still be on the topic in 10 years, hopefully, and hopefully also with some new insights and not all the same.
Yeah, and if I may then jump on to say the Hall technique is even easier. We did a study with, we did a study with an experienced pediatric dentist and some final year students, and they treated the children in schools, and they used the Hall technique, and they had both a very good success rates in the end of the study, because it's not really operator dependent when the operator is trained. I mean, they all got a training, and it's not a very extensive training. It's just like one afternoon, one workshop, and they all made it. So it's very easy.
But Clarissa, from all the treating options you mentioned, you didn't mention the pulpotomy. Does it have a place in your office at all, or do you think it doesn't have a place?
That's a good question. I think the pulpotomy has a place, and that's mainly for these lesions where you are still in doubt, because the combination of the clinical signs and the pain sometimes, and that you are still in doubt if you're leading with a reversible or irreversible pulp inflammation, then pulpitis, then you are still there. And if you're treating the child in the chair, I mean, not under general anesthesia, and you have a good cooperation, then you go for a pulpotomy. When you are treating under general anesthesia, you're normally a little bit more severe in your decisions, because there is a reason why this child is being treated under general anesthesia. Probably it's a child that's not treatable on the chair. And there you have to base your decisions much more on the x-rays. And there too, when you don't see a dentin breach, then you don't have a doubt and you do a pulpotomy or a pulpectomy or an extraction. And it's still depending on the size of the lesion and the position of the tooth. So if it's a 4 or a 5, how severe you can be. But there is for sure a room.
But for example, in my pedo department 10 years ago, I basically learned the stainless steel crown in combination with pulpotomy has also success rates over 90%. So I thought I learned the Hall is still even a bit better than this approach. So therefore, I would guess you tend more to the Hall technique.
Yeah, there are different indications for the pulpotomy and for only the Hall technique. And the reason why we place a stainless steel crown after a pulpotomy is also because you have a big cavity and you make a big hole to be able to make the pulpotomy. So you have a weak tooth underneath, then you want to protect it with the crown. And when you choose for it, it's actually because you cannot choose for the Hall technique anymore. Okay. So it's not comparable, I think.
Actually, I think Falk is a study you're working on comparing pulpotomy with selective caries. It was really interesting for me. I'm kind of waiting on the results. When do you think you will have these results? 2 years, 4 years, 5 years?
That's a good question. At the moment, we are recruiting, and we started about 2 to 3 months ago. I don't remember exactly. And it's quite an ambitious study. So the first results, hopefully in 2 years, but that will be only very, very preliminary results, maybe only from the first step without any kind of follow-up. So yeah, that's clinical research. It's just hard. It takes quite a while. That's why nobody wants to do it any longer. But yeah, it will be some years from now.
Do you think it would have potential to change the Cochrane review results if it favors pulpotomy?
Well, if it favored pulpotomy, then of course that would flow into the into the Cochrane Review, but that's something we don't know. So at the moment, the Cochrane Review stands as it is. These reviews, they don't tend to be updated every year because it's just a hell lot of work. So I think we will have that as a reference for the next at least 5 years, I would guess, that Cochrane Review with the data in there.
So I probably have to look up the review and put it in the show notes as well, since we talked so much about it. So I really thank you for the time. I'm glad, Falk, that you mentioned the word palpotomy and not me.
Well, it would be very sad if we couldn't go out of our house, or our academic house we built around ourselves by our work of the last decade, and not build a new house in case there's something interesting. So I'm very open to these new things. But on the other hand, I have my severe problems with people not accepting the not so new things like selective and stepwise removal, even if the data is there. So yeah, I'm happily mentioning the palpotomy. Maybe that's my way of convincing you, by the way. Maybe I mentioned palpotomy and then I convince you to accept selective removal. Is that a deal?
Well, we could agree on that so far. See? So we have
some
balance. Okay.
Common ground. Excellent.
Common ground. Okay, I see Clarissa is smiling a lot. That's great. Too bad we don't record any video today.
I'm very happy because I'm just like, today was a general anesthesia day that I didn't even have lunch. So I'm like this completely, I didn't expect any video. The video is on the laptop because I didn't even realize. But I was not looking for you, I'm sorry. So now I am.
It's okay.
Thinking and looking around. Forgot that the video was on.
I mean, I think in Amsterdam you have a quite good food delivery, and I hope you can order something after this podcast.
Oh, I had lunch before, dinner before. I have small children, so I eat with them very early.
Okay. I both thank you for the time, and I'm looking forward for your lecture online. So I just say goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.